From Europe to the Pacific Ocean, China is playing an ever greater role in the world. It has deepened its strategic alignment with Russia, and China's moves in relation to the Ukraine conflict are therefore closely watched. Meanwhile, observers speculate as to what action, if any, it might take towards Taiwan. Some democratic countries are also taking further steps to counter Chinese power in the Asia-Pacific region. Andrew Gillam, Principal and Director of Analysis for Greater China and North Asia at the global risk consultancy Control Risks, assesses China's complex partnership with Russia and its limits.
In the early weeks of the Ukraine war, there was a big perception that China had basically picked a side and thrown its lot in with Russia. Because, you know, you got a lot of op-eds, which you still get now, about the sort of, you know, the new, as of March or February, there is now a new world order. And that involves China and Russia versus, you know, China and Russia and friends versus the West and friends. And we're certainly a lot closer to that. And we're starting to see those, some of those dynamics. But I think that's a misunderstanding of China's position. China, I think, is still hugely conflicted about this. And all the stuff about, you know, unlimited partnership or no limits partnership is always the quote. It is ironic because that's emerging at a time where the most striking thing about it at the moment is the limits. So China's obviously not providing military support. And they're clearly very limited in how far they'll go in economic and financial support as well. Weird standoff where, on a very simplistic level, the situation in terms of where China and the US are in this is still the same as it was in the first week of the war, which is China is clearly sympathetic to Russia and clearly rejects a lot of the, they reject the whole Western narrative on, you know, who's to blame for the war and what it is and what's going on. And they explicitly, you know, loudly reject the legitimacy of most of the actions that have been taken by the West, mainly sanctions. And they're desperate not to see this succeed, either in terms of setting a precedent for sort of the West being able to kind of crush Russia, or in terms of losing Russia as a somewhat powerful partner globally on a lot of issues if Russia ends up, you know, sort of crippled by the eventual outcome. But on the other hand, China's also desperate not to basically get badly damaged by the fallout from associating with Russia. So they have actually not done that much, I think, in terms of what people thought they might do. They're not sort of systematically breaching sanctions. They're not bailing Russia out. They're obviously buying a lot more energy, but, you know, that's not really a bailout. But what's effectively happened is that China and India are sort of buying what Europe has stopped buying. It's not sanctioned. They're not breaching sanctions by buying that. But there's a lot of countries, I think, who are doing the same thing on a much smaller scale. And I think one reason the West hasn't actually sanctioned that is because they don't want an even bigger, you know, energy price crisis. And if China and Russia don't buy, I mean, it's kind of everybody's getting each other out of jail here in a way, because it allows, basically, if China and India weren't buying Russian oil and Russian oil is basically out of the market, then China and India will then be competing with the rest of the world to buy what's left, and you have even bigger price crisis. And I think Western countries know that.
Bonnie S. Glaser, director of the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund in Washington, D.C., expands on China's position on the Ukraine conflict, which to some observers may seem contradictory, and its relationship with Western powers.
China does not want to have a major deterioration in its relations with the West, particularly the United States and Europe, because it still needs access to technology. which it cannot get if it has a truly hostile relationship with the West. So it needs to continue to have students trained abroad. It wants to continue to be able to purchase some Western companies, Western investment in China. So all of this is still essential for Xi Jinping's ambition to put the country on a path toward national rejuvenation by the middle of the century. This war was certainly not in China's interests. If Russia had invaded Ukraine and achieved its goals very quickly, that probably would have benefited China. It would have perhaps strengthened Putin and Russia. But today we face, you know, international sanctions. Russia's economy is being weakened. So the war itself is, and its outcome as it continues, is not in China's interest. But I don't think that the relationship with Russia is seen by China as an inconvenience.
There's tension in relation to Taiwan, which regards itself as a sovereign state, but which Beijing sees as part of China. A Chinese official said in July that reunification is the main goal of Beijing's Taiwan strategy, contributing to fears of an invasion. Bonnie S. Glaser discusses how the Ukraine-Russia conflict is affecting China's calculations as to its next steps on Taiwan.
China will study this war from many different perspectives. The fact certainly that Europe has become more united, NATO has been strengthened, obviously these don't bode well for China in the event it invaded Taiwan. That said, Europe's interest, I think, is far deeper in Ukraine than it is in Taiwan. And the international community, or a large part of it, has imposed sanctions on Russia. It's still a question mark as to whether countries would be willing to impose those kinds of sanctions on China. I personally think it would be really challenging to get the world to freeze China's central bank, for example. So there are things that we can do. There may be different tools that we have and develop, but we've also given China, in a sense, a wake-up call. They will now prepare perhaps more diligently to be able to protect their economy from international sanctions. So in a sense, it works both ways. They will try to reduce their reliance, for example, on SWIFT, and figure out ways that in a crisis they can continue to operate their economy. Perhaps it will accelerate this dual circulation strategy again of making China less dependent on the world, but making the world more dependent on China. The biggest lesson that I think that will affect Chinese interests will be the Ukrainian resistance. In other words, if Taiwan learns the lesson that it should really prepare not just to stop the PLA from landing on the beach, but be prepared to fight an insurgency, to accelerate reform of its reserves, to create a civil defense, a territorial defense force, then China will face more resistance than it would have otherwise.
Yuka Kobayashi, professor of China and international politics at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, warns against viewing the Taiwan situation as similar to the Ukraine conflict.
I don't think China is merely calculating this in terms of power politics. If you're thinking about in terms of military prestige, yes, it would make sense. However, the other side of the coin is the economics, right? What happens if you actually take Taiwan by force? There's so much integration between Taiwan and the mainland. Look at the investors on the mainland, joint ventures, etc. If you actually take Taiwan by force, it's devastating for the mainland as well. And whether or not she is going to take it, it's really kind of, you know, we can't be clear. But I'm actually coming from the perspective that if you look at barely the pure economics of it all, and also in terms of human relations, how many Taiwanese actually have family in the mainland and vice versa? This is the danger in taking comparisons, which are like comparing apples and oranges. There are similarities there, yes. But it's very dangerous to draw these comparisons, given that it's very different situations. And the integration between Taiwan and Beijing in terms of economy, especially after the Maizhou period, has become much more closer. What you're hearing in terms of the military, the power arguments, yes, there's a lot there going for China to actually take Taiwan by force. But I think on the other side, there's a lot of economic calculations, and one that Beijing is weighing very carefully. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually of the side to think that there is a lot more going for Beijing to really try to go through this in a peaceful manner, to do this through the status quo.
In September 2021, Australia, the UK and the US announced a historic security pact in the Indo-Pacific region, known as AUKUS. Yuka Kobayashi assesses how China views the move and examines efforts by the democratic powers to counter China in the region more generally.
If you look at the actors, the United States, UK, Australia, these are all very much entangled in terms of the existing security partnership. But what AUKUS was a significant signal in terms of signaling to China that we are actually very much united. And I think, interestingly, it's not about just nuclear subs, it's about underwater cables, and it's about going forward where there's going to be a coordination in these areas. And these areas are really the new infrastructure and also the new areas where there's going to be defense and also economic activities integrated with that. So it's signaling this kind of decoupling from China, not just in terms of economy, but also in sectors where you have the economy very much entangled with defense. And I think in a sense, it did actually send a clear message to China in the sense that there was this kind of unity there. And the Indo-Pacific tilt that was actually just very much in name prior to that was now becoming materialized into very serious defense kind of partnerships. It's very clear this was targeted towards China. There was no doubt about it. I don't think that, Chinese doubted this was a message to China. And it's very clear the actors involved also meant it as a message to China. In terms of China's response to that, saying it undermines peace, in the sense that this free and open Indo-Pacific was very much of a loose network, and the U.S. hub and spoke systems but was bilateral security arrangements where U.S. had presence. But this was now bringing all of these things together in the Indo-Pacific and showing that this kind of tilt to the Indo-Pacific was serious, and it's not just about talk. And whether or not that really made things difficult for ASEAN countries who now had to choose between these Commonwealth countries and also China, it is actually true in the sense that it's most problematic for ASEAN countries who were now feeling a bit divided. And I think in that sense, historically, ASEAN has been very weak in terms of coordinating any kind of policy. If you think about the South China Sea, they've had a declaration of conduct way before this South China Sea tribunal between Philippines and China took place. So if the code of conduct was actually effective, none of that would have been necessary. But which shows you that the ASEAN loose framework was really ineffective for addressing a lot of these kinds of responses to China. And I think in a sense, you're actually really seeing more and more involvement with the United States if you think about what's been happening around Myanmar and ASEAN. So again, it shows that Southeast Asia has now become a really a forum for US, UK and Australia to become even more involved in regional issues.
Domestically, China has continued to enact a low tolerance policy towards the COVID-19 pandemic, using strict lockdowns to control the virus, in contrast to the more relaxed approaches being taken in other countries. Yun Zhou, scholarship officer of the IBA Corporate and M&A Law Committee and an equity partner at Zhonglun Law Firm based in Shanghai, discusses China's approach to the pandemic.
The government is quite used to applying very strict methods when they see a risk. They have really gotten used to administering a very strict control. And the challenge is really the balance between economy and the political agenda that they have to, to adhere to the zero COVID. Obviously, those two do not go along very well with each other. So that's the challenge for all political leaders. They are under tremendous pressure to keep the economy going. It is not a great economic overall situation. And then you have this. So you can imagine the challenges we're facing. Not yeah. only the political leaders, the businesses are actually living it. So yeah. they, you know, law firm business are hurt. You know, we are a business as well. And I also believe that the Chinese people in business are quite resilient. There are clear signs of coming back to business, and people are, you know, the numbers are coming up and people are getting busier and busier. The traffic, you know, you would tell from the Shanghai traffic jam, right? It was like 70% from what you feel when it first, you know, in late June when we opened up for business. It's like 70%, 80%. So traveling is much less of a pain. But so you can see things are going back to normal very quickly. But still, because you have, you know, here and there, you have changing policy. Traveling has become difficult and uncertain, and meetings get canceled, you know, flights getting canceled, etc.